So today's going to be mostly about KCFA and other CFAs that are out there. But I need to start with a correction. So thanks to Roz, he pointed out some work I was unaware of. And it looks like subcubic zero CFA should probably also be attributed to Chowdhury, certainly for primacy. But the story is even a little weirder than that because I did some digging. So it turns out that zero CFA has actually been subcubic since 1985. That's 3 years before zero CFA even existed. So it turns out that the reason we all thought zero CFA was cubic was a paper by Hines and McAllister from 1997. They reduced it to 2NPDA, or two-way non-deterministic PDA, and claimed in that paper that that particular problem was cubic and had been cubic for several decades and was probably unlikely to ever get better than cubic, when in fact in 1985, Ritter had already shown that it was subcubic. Or n cubed over log n. So what the Chowdhury paper does is it shows that you can use this to solve some recursive state machine problems, which directly implies that you can solve zero CFA in cubic time. I looked at the paper. I didn't see a direct reference to zero CFA, but it's a very trivial extension of that paper. So then what the Mittgard and Van Horn paper does is work directly with the Ritter framework, skips going through recursive state machines, and creates an explicitly subcubic zero CFA. So that's the final word on subcubic zero CFA, unless somebody else has more related work from perhaps the 60s. And some clarifications. So I use the terms partially correct and totally correct without defining them. So if you prove a static analysis is partially correct, then you've proven that its results are sound for terminating programs. If you prove a static analysis totally correct, you've proven that its results are sound for all programs. And that's the difference here. And the reason it's actually important is that a lot of the constraint-based zero CFAs are justified with the big step semantics. And the big step semantics makes proving total correctness somewhat cumbersome, and a lot of papers just don't do it. And I found some papers out there, I found one paper, where the algorithm was partially correct but totally incorrect, which is a little weird. So that's why I bothered making the distinction yesterday. Yesterday Olivier said, when two people use the same word, becomes useful. So we'll call that Donvey's law. And I came up with Mite's conjecture based on the exchange I had with Giannis yesterday, which is that when two people use the same word but disagree on its meaning, the word can become dangerous. And the words I want to clarify, because I think they're actually used in slightly different ways between two different communities, are things like polyvariant, monovariant, context-sensitive, and context-insensitive. So these are the words that I'm going to pin down with a lot of formal machinery today and tell you what higher order people mean when they speak these words. And hopefully Andre will at some point tell us what the alias analysis people and the imperative people think when they use these words. Because I do think there's some subtle differences here. So the overall theme is how do you get better precision than zero CFA? And the short answer is you can go to something like KCFA. And KCFA is interesting because it's an infinite hierarchy of analyses. And K, in this case, is some natural number, including zero. And the great property about KCFA is that when you instantiate K plus one, it's always going to be more precise than the kth analysis. And another really interesting feature is that if you set K equal to infinity, you actually get the concrete semantics back. So out of curiosity, can anybody think of an instance where you'd actually want to run infinite CFA? When would you actually do that? Well, yeah. So I mean, yeah. If you're too lazy, if you want to write just the static analysis, then get an evaluator out of it. Yeah, you could do that. Well, how about if you have some other way of proving that your program terminates? So if you know the program terminates, you might as well run infinite CFA, as long as the complexity of the program is not exponential or something like that. You can just run it and get it back. And then the other reason is you can avoid writing a concrete interpreter. There's another use which is related to that one. And if you're publishing in the LNCS format where you have a very limited number of pages, you can just give the abstract semantics and then say set k equal to infinity, and that gives you the concrete semantics. I've done that before. It seems to work. So in abstract interpretation, there's sort of a fundamental observation about how you get precision. And that's that the structure of the abstraction, how you carve up the abstract state space, or really the concrete state space, determines the level of precision you get in the analysis. So I want to briefly review how we did that carving up and talk about how KCFA and how a lot of other analyses in general get better precision by manipulating this abstraction relation ultimately. So the abstraction map takes us from the infinite concrete state space down to some finite abstract state space. The concretization map takes us the other direction. You start with an abstract state, you get back some set of concrete states that it represents. I'm about to give you an oversimplification of what concretization does, but you can think of concretization as partitioning the concrete state space in some sense. And what KCFA and a lot of other analyses do as they scale up in precision is they construct successively more fine-grained partitions. So as you continue to partition the state space, you get better and better precision out of your analysis because when you're trying to transition, you now know that you're not just transitioning from this whole quadrant, you're only transitioning from here. So you want to have more information as you restrict the partitions. So the way I visualize what KCFA is doing is cutting up ever larger partitions or ever smaller partitions of the abstract state space or the concrete state space. The problem with just saying we'll fix the abstraction, particularly for the model we were using yesterday, was that there really wasn't much else we could do with the abstraction function. It was already sort of painfully awkward to work with it, and it's hard to see how we could go beyond that. But this is a standard problem in abstract interpretation, and it has a standard solution. If the meaning of the program doesn't suit you, change the meaning. Give yourself a new semantics to work with. And this is why when you look at a concrete semantics from a static analysis paper, it looks nothing like the semantics you would write having just gotten out of your first year graduate programming language semantics class. In abstract interpretation, the workflow is write down a concrete semantics, try your abstraction, see if that's got the precision you want. Inevitably, it won't. Then you go back, you try to work the abstraction some more. And when you can't change the abstraction function anymore, then it's time to re-engineer the concrete semantics themselves. So you reformulate the concrete semantics, and then maybe you can wiggle with the abstraction function some more. You just go back and forth between changing the abstraction function and the concrete semantics until you get the precision and the speed and the power you need out of the analysis.
Are you actually changing the semantics?
Or good point. So the meaning of the program will stay absolutely the same, but the way you compute the meaning will change. Yeah. I said that wrong. I'm not changing the meaning. I'm just changing the way you express the meaning. Meaning stays the same. I was trying to figure out, because the first time I saw the concrete semantics for KCFA or the concrete semantics you start with to get KCFA, it just looked weird to me. It was because I'd just taken a graduate semantics class. I thought this is not the way I was taught to write an interpreter. This is just weird and bogus looking. Over the years, I've tried to figure out why Olin started that way, because he can't actually remember why he started that way. But I think I figured it out now. And actually, I think Olivier gave me a big clue yesterday when talking about John Reynolds. So if you want to sort of stumble onto KCFA, I figure there's a couple ways you could do it. Or really, if you do all three of these things, you're definitely going to get there. If you add letrec, it'll force you to make some changes to the semantics. There's only a few ways you can add letrec, and one of the ways will lead you towards KCFA. There's a few ways you can add side effects, and if you overlap with the way you add letrec, you get the way you add KCFA, or you get to KCFA. But ultimately, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make the state space non-recursive, and this is what Olivier pointed out yesterday was sort of like one of John Reynolds' rules for simple, for making the semantics simple and unambiguous. You want to work with something like a non-recursive state space, and it just so happens that John Reynolds was on Olin's PhD committee, and he spent a lot of time in John Reynolds' office working out the mathematics behind KCFA. And so I have no doubt that the reason the semantics were phrased as they were is because he was working with John Reynolds. It's probably not because he had a letrec or side effects. His co-supervisor. So let's go ahead and add letrec, and then we'll see what this forces us to do the semantics. I'll do the right thing instead of the wrong thing. And then we'll head towards KCFA. So adding letrec is pretty simple. I'm going to do non-mutually recursive letrec. It's not that hard to extend this framework to add a mutually recursive letrec. But all we're doing is adding a new call form. So if you've just finished your first year graduate semantics class, what are some ways you could add recursion to a language? There's sort of two standard techniques people use. So what's one way? Begins with an F. You guys ever heard of fixed points? Okay, so fixed points is one way. That's the standard way. You have recursive domains, and you can use fixed points to express, you know, closures that look like they're infinite. The other way is you don't add recursion to the language itself. You desugar the recursion using something like the Y combinator. And I trust you've all seen the Y combinator. So I think actually for the original zero CFA, I think Olin actually used the Y combinator. I don't think he had let rec. But these are bad options. So because this keeps the state space recursive, and recursive is bad. Particularly because when you have a recursive state space, it makes your abstraction functions very awkward because you can't express them in sort of a component-wise or naturally recursive fashion. Because if your domains are recursive, you might sort of walk along infinitely, and your abstraction function might not even be defined at that point. The real solution is to make the environment non-recursive by doing a binding factoring. So what that looks like is sort of like is the following: you end up with two environments instead of one. So environments, as we've been using them, are recursive. An environment is a map from variables into closures, which contains a lambda term and an environment. So environments reference environments. In a binding factored environment, we have a binding environment which takes the place of this guy inside closures, and then we have a store off to the side, which is almost sort of like a global variable. And the binding factored environment will take in a variable like the original environment did, but instead of giving you a value back, it's going to give you back an address. And then when you go over to the store will take that address and give you back the value you wanted. Except you'll notice that the environment we're using inside of closures is now the binding environment. We're not using the original environments. And this is, if you want to think about how you get from one view to the other, it's sort of like if you composed the binding environment with the store, you'd get something that sort of looked like the original environment. But not totally, because remember, when you the value you get back is going to have these instead of environments that look like that. So we're not going to do a let and set bang version explicitly, but that's sort of the way some of the semantics will actually operate. Yeah. So the way a language like Scheme handles let rec is through lets and sets. It just goes through the store, and we're not going to desugar into lets and sets. But the semantics will, in effect, in one transition relation, do lets and sets. There will never be a point where a recursively bound variable is undefined, which is in fact the case for Scheme. So when we throw that into the concrete state space, this is what we get back. So instead of having just that single environment, we now have a binding environment and a store sitting up here. And this binding environment is the context we want to evaluate this call in. And for the addresses, we'll gradually get more restrictive about what this can be. But for the moment, any infinite set will do. We just can't run out of them, that's all. So how do we use this new environment structure? Well, when you want to look up a variable, grab your binding environment, and you get the address of that variable. Once you've got the address, you drop it into the store. And the store will tell you the value sitting at that address. So now it's now a two-stage process, which means we have to slightly modify our evaluation function. So it takes both a binding environment and a store, and it does exactly that lookup process I just described. And for closures, the process stays the same. It just includes the binding environment. Now, for adding to the environment, it's a three-stage process now. We have to allocate a fresh address. Then we have to go to the environment we want to extend and extend it so that the variable gets bound to this new address. And after that, we have to go to the store, and we have to extend the store as well. Now, we're not mutating the store, we're extending the store. This is all math. There are no side effects in math. So we take the store, and we add this address to get bound to whatever value we want to bind that variable to. So one question we have to answer is, where are we going to get a fresh address from? And I can think of three different options, at least three. And only one of these is a very good one. So you could just look in the domain of the store and say, what hasn't been allocated? Pick one of those non-deterministically and use that. Non-determinism is a really bad idea if your ultimate goal is abstract interpretation. It might be a fine thing to do if you were just interested in defining the meaning of a language, but if you want to actually do an analysis, non-determinism is bad. Another possibility is, you know, we could construct some sort of total ordering on addresses, or at least an infinite partial ordering or well-founded partial ordering or something like that. And then, you know, every time we need a new address, we can look at what the top address is and allocate something above that. We could do that. But that's going to have a very awkward abstraction pattern. It just doesn't quite fit very well. So ultimately what we're going to do is thread a timestamp through the semantics itself. So these timestamps are going to be attached to every single state. And the nice thing about time is that every time you move forward, it's at a time you've never been to. So time is in some sense a source of freshness. And you can stir time into all the constructs that need to have some sort of freshness associated with them. And the only real constraints we have on what these timestamps are is that we have to have an infinite number of them. And any timestamp we've got has to be monotonically increasable. We have to always be able to go to some timestamp after it. So here's the semantics with timestamps, or here's the state space with timestamps added in. So all this changes, we've tacked this on up here, and we've added in this set of timestamps. So putting that all together, we'll arrive at a concrete semantics that looks something like this. So now it's going to have two rules. We're going to have a rule for function call, and we're going to have a rule for let rec. So up here, we're evaluating some function call. The argument is f, so we look up, the function is f, so we look up using the evaluator f. What we get back is a closure. So ultimately, we want to end up in the body of this lambda term, and we want to end up extending this environment right here. So before we can extend the environment, we have to know which values we need to bind those the variables in that environment to. So for all of the arguments up here, we evaluate them. That's what this line is doing right here. And it's getting back a closure for every single one of those. So then we actually look at the lambda term. When we look at the lambda term, we can pull out the body. And this is where we're headed to. So now we know the call site we're at. Next, we need to actually extend the environment with the bindings from these variables to these values. So to get addresses for these variables, we're first going to bump the timestamp. And we're going to bump the timestamp using a function called tick. Tick just advances time one step forward. And for reasons that will become more obvious later, it's going to also take in the current call site when it's choosing a next time. You certainly don't need that information to choose a next time, but it's something that KCFA will end up relying upon. So we're going to be guaranteed that whatever comes out of here, it's going to be bigger than the time we've got right now. Then we have a second external parameter, this alloc function. This alloc function is going to take the time, and it's also going to take a variable. And it's going to give you back a fresh address for that variable. So once we've got the addresses for all the variables we're about to bind, we can take the environment out of the closure, and we can extend it so that each of those variables gets an address we just allocated. Once they're all allocated, we go into the store to say these addresses got these values, the arguments that have just been passed in. So it's no longer, it's 9 lines now instead of 3 or 4. It's a little more complicated, but still not too bad. And then for let rec, it is a little bit simpler, but we do basically the same thing. Except this time we only have one value to allocate. So we're going to advance the time. We're going to allocate an address. This is the address we're going to bind the recursive procedure to. Then, instead of evaluating the lambda term, we extend the environment early. So this is where the virtual lets and sets comes into the scene. We extend the environment before the evaluation. So we say this variable gets bound to this address. Then we evaluate the lambda term with the environment we just created. So this environment can see this lambda term through V. And that's what it's going to get inside of its closure. And then we go into the store after we've allocated that closure or evaluated that closure, and we bind this address to that closure. So this is the let rec trick. And you can use, obviously if you want to do side effects, adding a store like this is one of the natural things you'd do too. So those two parameters have the following signatures. Tick takes in a call, whatever call site you're at, and a time, and it gives you back a new time. The alloc function takes in a variable, which is the variable you're trying to allocate an address for, and the current or and the next time, I guess, really, and it gives you back an address. And the reason that call is tucked in there will become, again, apparent as we go into KCFA. And we can formalize the constraints that these functions have to obey. So the first one is that time is monotonic, which means if you allocate a new time, it had better be bigger in some sense than the time that came before. We also have sort of a local uniqueness constraint, which says that if two variables are different and you allocate them using the same time, you're going to get back different addresses. And then sort of a global uniqueness constraint, which says that if two times are different, then they're definitely not going to give you back the same address. So there's a very, so again, if you're in your semantics class and you're just trying to define the meaning of the language, there's a very easy solution to those constraints. Just use the natural numbers. You know, numbers are a very natural way of thinking about time. So if you use the natural numbers for time, then you can also just pair a variable with the current time to get an address. And then the tick function, all it's doing, the tick function right now doesn't even pay attention to what the call site is. It doesn't need it at all. It just bumps up the time by one. And then the allocation function just pairs the variable with the current time. This is going to break down when we try to do abstract interpretation. But again, if all we cared about was the meaning of the language, this would work just fine. So now we're going to look at how we abstract that particular concrete semantics into KCFA.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, say that again.
In case of distributed systems, when you are using...
So, I mean, I guess if you were using some sort of distributed model and you know, or parallel model and they couldn't all agree on times, you might have some problems there. But there are ways around even that sort of thing, because time doesn't have to be an integer. And you could actually, you know, you could have different versions of times, I guess. You could have green time for you know this process and red time for that process, and they can each allocate their own colored times, and you'd be fine. So there are ways around these sorts of problems. But in the end, we're not going to actually use integers for time anyway. So this is the state space for KCFA. And one thing you'll notice is that it's in a more direct correspondence than the last abstract state space we had. The only real change is that we now have a power set of closures here. In contrast to the earlier zero CFA, closures do have environments now. They still get a binding environment. And of course, the set of abstract addresses has to be finite, and the set of times has to be finite. So now that there's another question we should ask, which is the state space finite? You know, this is a question from somebody yesterday, and it's worth answering it now. So who thinks the state space is finite? Who thinks it's infinite? Who has no idea? So I think the quickest way to convince ourselves that it's finite, or at least one way, is to show that it's non-recursive and that it grounds out in finite leaves. And so we can do that by drawing arrows, you know, from every use of a domain down to its definition. And if we can structure the semantics that all the arrows are going downwards, then we have a DAG, and it's not recursive. There's no cycles. So we can do that. It took me like 3 tries to find the right ordering on the domains, which is kind of annoying, but there's not that many orderings possible. But this is the right ordering, and you can see all the arrows are going downwards. So the semantics are, or the domains are not recursively defined, and they all ground out ultimately down in these leaves down here, which are finite. The other way you can convince yourself of this is to actually go sort of one by one through all of the components of the state space. You can say, are there a finite number of call sites? Yes. Is there a finite number of times? Yes. Finite number of binding environments? Maybe. Look here and say, well, okay, so binding environments are made out of... So binding environments are basically, it's a table of variables cross addresses. There's only a finite number of addresses. Okay, so binding environments are finite. Let's see. Let's work our way back to stores. So stores are addresses and power sets of closures. So we know addresses are finite. How about closures? Closures are lambda terms and binding environments, which are finite. So yeah, that's finite too. So hopefully you now all believe that the state space is finite. Does anybody doubt it now? Okay. Good. Hmm. Yep.
Can you say again why the
set of addresses isn't finite? Well, say why the set of addresses isn't what? For the abstraction. So one way to ensure termination static analysis is restrict yourself to a finite space. Because then you can bounce around all you want, and eventually you'll come back to the same place.
In the
concrete semantics, they're infinite.
Okay, so you're
yeah, so when you go from the concrete, you have an infinite set of times, infinite set of addresses. When you go to the abstract, you have a finite set of addresses, finite set of times. Yeah. This is really the key change that you make. Once you make this change, it forces you into making this change right here, because otherwise you can't properly represent a concrete state. Yes. In fact, we will solve for the correct abstraction. This is what we're going to end up solving for right here. The abstractions of addresses and times, we'll actually solve for them. But the other stuff abstracts much more naturally now. We don't have any of this weird, find all the reachable environments inside some other environment. Everything abstracts component-wise. And what component-wise means is, you abstract, across each component of the state. And then as you go in, you're sort of abstracting, recursively down the structure of all the components within the state. So states abstract by abstracting the binding environment, you abstract the store, and you abstract the time. To abstract a binding environment, you give back a new function, and what it does is it looks up the concrete value it would have gotten, and then just abstracts that directly. And for a store, it takes in, for an abstracted store, it takes in an abstract address, and it finds all of the concrete addresses which abstract to the address you got in here. And then uses all of those addresses to look up, or it looks up all of those addresses in the concrete store you told it to abstract, abstracts all of those, and joins them all together. So again, I promised I wouldn't actually use any joins I wouldn't define, so here's the definition of join on stores. You'll notice it looks suspiciously like the join we had on environments. The way join works on stores is, you give it an address, it looks up the address in both of the stores, and then it merges them together. And merge in this case is just union. It's possible, if you have non-flat, value domains, then you can't actually just use union. But I think for all the stuff I'm doing, I have flat value domains. Let's see. And then for a closure, to abstract a closure, you put it inside a singleton set, and you keep the same lambda term, obviously, and then you subtract the environment. How these abstract are really going to depend on what values we end up choosing for the tick function and the alloc function, as well as the abstract counterparts of the tick function and the alloc function. So what we'll end up doing is choosing abstract versions of the tick function and the alloc function, putting some limits on how those have to behave in order to meet a soundness theorem, and then I'm sure Raz's sketching tool at that point could tell us what the abstraction function should be. So the components of the state space, the components of the semantics are basically the same as last time. We've got a transition relation, which takes us from one abstract state into another, or could take us to multiple subsequent abstract states, really. And then we have this helper function, which, given an expression, a binding environment, an abstract store, gives us back a set of possible closures that could evaluate from that expression. So the only real difference here is that we have to put the closure we get back in a singleton set. Otherwise, it's basically exactly the same as what the concrete one does. And then for the semantics, it looks mostly the same, but I'll walk back through it just so you can see where all the differences are. Again, the real differences are here. This is where the non-determinism comes from, and here. And this is where the soundness and the imprecision comes from. So this is the joining and the merging. This is a membership rather than equality. So in this rule, we are evaluating some function call. So the first thing we do is we take that function and we give it to the current environment and the current store. Now, remember, this abstract evaluator is going to give us back a set of things. It's going to give us back a set of abstract closures. So we can't just say we're only going to pick one. We have to go to all, you have to branch to all possible closures we could be invoking at this point. So for every closure, we have, a subsequent state. Then we look up all of the arguments. And we get, for each argument, we get back a set of closures for each argument. After that, we look at the lambda term itself. We pull the call site out of the lambda term. And this tells us which call site we're at next, because we want to go into the body of whatever closure we're invoking. And again, we have to allocate space for the variables we're about to bind. So first, we do this abstract bumping of time with this abstract tick function. And it takes in roughly it takes in the abstract versions of what the concrete one took in. It takes in a call site, and it's going to take in the current timestamp. The abstract allocator is going to behave just like its concrete counterpart, too. It's going to take in the variable we're allocating an address for, and it's going to take in the newly incremented timestamp, because we know this is a source of freshness. After that, we take the environment from the closure, because we're lexically scoped, and we extend it. We take the variables out of the lambda term, and we bind them to the addresses we just allocated here. We then go take those addresses and bind them to the arguments that got passed into this particular function. And when we do the binding, we're actually merging. In static analysis, it's sometimes it is safe not to merge. There are occasions, we're going to get into some of those tomorrow. But if you don't know exactly how many concrete addresses are being represented by this abstract address, you could throw away possibilities by overriding. And so this is why you have to join instead, so that you preserve all the possible concrete counterparts. For LetRec, it looks basically the same. The only difference here, so there's no non-determinism when you're evaluating a LetRec rule. So the only difference here is going to be this join. And again, we have this trick with the environment. So we bump the time in the abstract. And one thing I guess I should mention about this is, obviously, because you're allocating from an abstract or from a finite set of times, you can get the same time twice in the abstract. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to happen. Times in the abstract have no order on them in terms of which came before which. Times is not even really an appropriate word for them at that point. They're just abstractions of the original times, but they don't behave like time at all anymore. And that's another reason, and that's another way you can justify this merging here, is that you might have to have, because there's a finite set of times, you have a finite set of addresses. Each address may have to have multiple values living at it. And if addresses have to share, then they have to merge rather than overwrite. But once again, the same trick we use in the concrete works in the abstract. We create the environment first and then evaluate the lambda term, so that the environment the lambda term gets is the one where it can see its own binding. And then we just update the store. So these are the signatures for those two parameters that we used in the abstract. Abstract tick takes in a call site, abstract time gives you back a new time. The abstract allocator takes in a variable, takes in a time, gives you back an address. So I thought it would be good at this point to see if you're all following along, is to actually do maybe a 5-minute exercise and see if you can actually write down the rule for let. So this is the concrete version. After this, we'll do the abstract version. So let's take 5 minutes or so now and see if you can come up with the rules for let in CPS for this framework we've been using. It's simpler than both letrec and call. All let does is you get a new call site, new binding environment, new store, and new time. So all four components are new. I will put up the rule for letrec. That's the abstract rule, but set k equal to infinity, and that's the concrete. So, yeah. If you want the concrete, take the hats off and ignore that. All right. Well, I saw some people were getting pretty close. Does anybody feel confident enough in their answer to write it on the board? No? Okay. I'll just show you what it is then. And you can use this as sort of like a checkpoint or debugging aid for yourself on how well you're understanding what I'm teaching you. And if you're getting lost, let me know so that I can help correct that sort of stuff. I meant to put that up too as a reference. All right, so here's the answer. You've always got to advance the time, so you advance the time. You're going to need a new address, so you allocate an address. You have to evaluate whatever the value is you're about to bind, so you do that. Then you make the binding in the current environment, extend it so that V gets bound to whatever address you just allocated, and then you update the store. Olivia? Mm-hmm. Yes, you would obtain exactly the same equation. I take that back. You'd be two time steps ahead. because if you macro expand, then you're going to run time. You're going to run tick twice. I think other than that, it'll be basically the same. So actually, when I do stuff like that, sometimes I use tick and talk, and you know, talk is like half of a tick. So if you do two talks, you can get one tick, if that's ever necessary. So it sounds like you get something similar to what happens when you use the Y Combinator. I can't be sure. Is that what they're doing in SML, is using an instance of the Y Combinator? So the Y Combinator, if you use that approach, if you don't inline it everywhere you use it, then you get miserable precision. So if you do use the Y Combinator, at least make sure you inline it everywhere, because otherwise everything's going to flow through the Y Combinator and everything will flow to everywhere. And it'll just be a giant spaghetti control flow graph. And so then the abstract looks basically identical, except we do a join here instead. Was anybody close? I saw a few people who were close. Yeah. Yeah.
But it seems the crucial point is how you abstract from the infinite time and infinite allocations within. I really don't understand. It seems it pops out of the box, but I don't see it.
I haven't at all explained how we're going to do that abstraction yet. But that's coming up very soon. Yeah. No. If you're confused, it's because I haven't told you anything about that yet. Yeah. All right, so to get to that abstraction, we're going to solve for it by adding together all of our constraints. So if you try to prove a soundness theorem without knowing what the abstract tick and alloc functions are doing, these will fall out as lemmas. And what they basically say, I mean, they're simulation lemmas for the tick function and the alloc function. They say that, you know, if you have a time that abstracts some time, and you tick it in the concrete and you abstract it, it's got to be consistent with the time you'd have gotten if you just ticked the abstract time. And you get exactly the same sort of thing for allocation. So this is a solution that KCFA uses without the abstraction functions. Because once you pin all these down, there's only one abstraction function left that you can use that will make it sound, that will make those prior constraints go through. So KCFA doesn't use time. Or it doesn't use natural numbers for time. If you use natural numbers for time, there'd be no way to abstract them correctly, because natural numbers are just like, it's like you'd have to go from a natural number into some abstract time, which in this case is a sequence of call sites, and it just doesn't work out. So what KCFA does, it says for time, let it be a sequence of call sites. So in the concrete semantics, the current time is all the call sites you have been through since the start of the program. You just keep updating as you go through. So every time you hit a new call site, you append it onto the front. And of course, this is going to give you a unique time every single time. You take a sequence of length n, you add something on, it's a sequence of length n plus 1. And the allocation function, of course, doesn't change either. You just pair the variable with the time you've got. So that's a perfectly suitable definition of time. And in time, if you can't tell, it's synonymous with context and contour and history. All these other terms would sometimes float around in the static analysis community. So time is context. So when we say context sensitive, this is where the context is going to come from. Now in the abstract, for KCFA, what it does is it says the current time is the last k call sites I've been through. So that's where the k in KCFA comes from. You're bounding the amount of history you remember. You're bounding how far back you know where you've been. And then when you tick a time, you append the current call site onto the time you've got right now, and then you just take the first k elements. Or you can view is dropping the last element off. So now you're back to a string of at most length k. Again, the allocation function works exactly the same. Yep. No, it is not. So it's a sequence of calls, not the sequence of calls and returns. So it is possible, but I don't believe it's widely known that you can do, you know, sort of a stack-based version of time, or a sort of a stack-based abstraction for this sort of stuff. If you look at my work on Delta CFA, you can do it with something like that. I think there's a few other methods for doing it too, but it's not widely. Oh, Roz. Why it's not a stack? Because it ignores returns. You know, so if you look at a sequence of calls, and you had some intermediate returns, those aren't taken into account because those would actually change what's on the top of the call string.
These are not in the stack.
They're not in the stack. So what I'm saying is like the last k calls you've been through, you could have called a few things, returned. Called, return, called, return, called, return, and so, you know. Oh, yeah, exactly the same notion. Yep. It's just a call string. In CPS it would correspond to the stack, but not in direct style. Unless you actually, you know, partition your view of CPS so that you distinguish, you know, true lambdas from continuation lambdas, and then you can actually recover the stack in CPS. But we're not doing that. So if you execute CPS literally, then it's basically the stack. And you also have to ignore tail calls, you have to ignore tail call optimization as well. So then the abstraction function, to go from a concrete time into an abstract time, what it's going to do is just take the first k elements of the concrete call string. And then again, to abstract an address, it's just going to abstract whatever address is associated with it, or whatever time is associated with the address. All the constraints we've had so far, you know, say this is the only possible solution to those equations. So now what I want to do is get into, you know, context-sensitive and polyvariance and pin them down a little more concretely. So context sensitivity is, I guess informally, it's you know, how sensitive is your analysis to where you've been or your history. I've seen the term abused in higher order in the higher order full analysis community to mean more than just history, but also things like evaluation context and stacks and things like that, which aren't strictly, you know, the last k things you've done, but mostly it's how much history are you dragging around with you, With KCFA, bumping up K gives you a way to drag around a very specific kind of history. You get more call string data. And obviously, you know, the bigger your K, the bigger your abstract state space. You know, the bigger your abstract state space, the more room you have to run. So how big is that abstract state space? Well, I proved it was finite, but I should have called it almost infinite. Because this is how big it is. It's like quadruply exponential. It's a very, very big abstract state space. This is one of the reasons why k greater than 1 is not particularly useful. Although I'll show you even later on with k equal to 0, you still have an exponential state space, and it still takes some more work to get to the classic cubic time 0 CFA. So this is how k impacts your abstract state space. You get a lot more room to run every time you increment k. And polyvariance in the higher community means, you know, what is the maximum number of abstract addresses you could allocate to an individual variable? You know, how many variants are there on a variable in the abstract? That's essentially what polyvariance means in this community. And so in KCFA, the polyvariance of a variable is the number of call sites, not to the k. Oh, yeah, to the k. It's the number of call sites raised to k. So in one CFA, you're pairing each variable with an individual call site. So every variable has, you know, however many call sites out there forms in the abstract. If k is 0, then a variable is just paired with nothing. And so zero CFA is called monovariant. There's only one variation, one variant of a variable in the abstract. So now what we'll do is instantiate KCFA for k equals 0 and k equals 1. And we'll end up solving for 0 CFA and 1 CFA. Yeah, it helps us, I think, see them in their simplified forms, or I guess what would be called their degenerate forms. So when we instantiate this everything with k equals 0, there's only one abstract time we ever deal, or there's only one abstract time anymore. It's just the empty sequence. And so a lot of stuff we can get rid of. You know, we already know what the time is. We don't need time down here. We already know what the time would be here, so we don't need it. Up in the binding environments, the binding environment becomes a submap of the identity map, so we don't need to carry environments around anymore. We can just throw environments out, and we end up with something that looks almost identical to the semantics we had last time with 0 CFA. In fact, here's the state space we had last time, and I guess that should be total. But if you inline this right here, then they're alpha equivalent to one another. The only difference is that now we're calling it a store. Here we called it, you know, this you know, mashed up global environment. But they're the same thing. And the semantics get simplified as well. So if you percolate all of the simplifications through, then this is the rule you get back, which looks exactly like the rule we had last time for 0 CFA. And we didn't do LetRec last time, but LetRec is very simple. You know, because there's no time, you don't have to do any of the bumping here. All you're doing when you get to LetRec is you're just adding this variable to be bound to this particular lambda term in the store. So for 1 CFA, we can make a few simplifications to the abstract state space. So time here is, you know, effectively the same as the set of calls. And you know, you'll notice we never actually need to use the current time beyond bumping it. You know, when we want to actually allocate something with the new time, we always know what the new time is. The new time comes from the current call site, so we don't need to carry this abstract timestamp up here anymore. You know, whenever we need whatever the new abstract time is, we just look at the call site and that's it. So we can simplify this a little bit. So we don't have the time component anymore, and other than that, you know, we've inlined calls as part of addresses. So again, it's polyvariant in the number of call sites. For every call site, you have a different possible abstract address for the variable. Something I'll point out now and again later on is that you're highly unlikely to bind the variable against every single call site. I mean, that function would have to be called against every call site in the program, which is very rare. Most functions only get called in a few places. So you very rarely actually exploit a lot of the state space. And in solving for 1 CFA, we just basically, everywhere we had tick, we just inline call. And so we end up with call here and call here. So as you're invoking a function, you're taking its arguments and you're mixing them with the current call site. So this binding has some sort of memory of where it got called from. So I think now it might be somewhat useful to go back through the same program we did for 0 CFA yesterday and see what happens with 1 CFA. So what I'd like is for, you know, you can pair up in teams or something like that, but just try to work through what the abstract transitions for this machine would be. So here are the first two. Obviously, you start off with the initial call site and bottom, and then you end up binding the identity function. So you create this is the abstract address it gets bound to. It was bound at the first call site, and it was obviously every address contains the variable it was bound for, and then that address is bound to a singleton set containing just the identity function. So this is lambda 1, that's lambda 2, that's lambda 3. So let's go ahead and take like 5 minutes and see how far people can get expanding out that right there. I'll tell you right now, it's going to be smaller than the graph we had yesterday. Even though the worst case complexity of the analysis is higher, the graph you get back will be smaller. And you can use this right here as a reference. if you look carefully, you'll see right in the very next state that comes after this why it's going to have better precision. Has anybody made it through one transition yet? States get kind of big. Yeah, by the way, before you ever actually implement a flow analysis in a compiler, I would highly recommend working it out like this on paper first. It's a very good exercise in making sure you actually understand how it's supposed to work. All right, let's go ahead and see what actually happens in this case. So all these states are in a row now. There's no looping. You don't ever loop back on a previous state. And I'll try to point out where the magic happens. So the magic happens here and here. Last time we got into trouble when we invoked the same continuation twice, or, from different points. The reason that doesn't happen here is because when Q gets bound, it gets context from wherever it's at mixed in. Whatever call site it's at gets mixed in. So when Q gets bound for the first time, it gets bound in the context of call 2. So Q bound to call 2 is a singleton set right here. And then when it gets bound again, it gets bound in the context of call 3. So it gets to stay a singleton set down here. And we're actually never going to invoke that Q again. We can't even see it anymore. If you were to run garbage collection, it would get thrown away. Because we never get that merging, we basically just run the concrete semantics of the program. So the interesting thing here is that we got both better speed and higher precision, or at least it took less transitions, and we got more precise results. Even though the worst complexity of the one CFA I've shown so far is massively quadruply exponential. In fact, if there's one constant I've discovered in working with static analysis, it's that the worst the complexity of my analyses get, the faster they run in practice. It's almost guaranteed that the slower it gets on paper, the more you want to run it. So at this point, I can actually draw an illustration of some of the differences between precision and zero CFA and one CFA. So what I'll do now is draw out some of the flows for one CFA. So if you've got two call sites to the same lambda, so here we're invoking f on x, f is bound to this lambda term, and here we're invoking on some other argument a. One CFA is going to see a call going into this lambda term. And by the way, this is sort of back. I'm thinking in direct style again. When you call this lambda term, one CFA sees you going in here. It sees x going into q. And then it sees a return from here to here with the computation we did on Q. Then it's going to see a separate invocation of this procedure. We're going to go into that lambda term again. And it's going to return exactly back, or sorry. And then it's also going to see this argument flow into Q, but be kept separate and distinct from the earlier binding of Q. And then we're going to return exactly back to where we got here. So we're not going to mix up which site we're returning to. When we switch over to zero CFA, zero CFA is going to start mixing these things up. So one thing one CFA buys you gives you a better approximation of where things are supposed to return to. It's harder to get it wrong, at least in one CFA. You can still get it wrong, but you have to stack up some context to trick it into getting it wrong. In zero CFA, you don't need to stack up context. You just need to call the procedure twice. Because zero CFA will see return flow from here, from this call site returning to here, and it will think that this particular call site could also return to here. It's going to get their continuations confused. And it's also going to confuse the what arguments it sees when it's evaluating these different invocations of the function as well. So it's going to look like f is being evaluated with both with a up here and x down here and vice versa. I think what we'll do now is reconstruct KCFA, but for anormal form. Yeah, so far I've been doing everything with CPS. CPS is nice and simple, but there's one trick you have to learn if you want to do this on a direct style language, which has something like a stack. Once you learn that trick, you can just use it for all the other direct style languages out there. And it's simplest to see if you look at it for anormal form. And there are reasons to prefer anormal form even besides CPS. One big one is that CPS is generally considered a global transform. Olivia mentioned some work yesterday on Scala, and I know in that work they actually do some static analysis to do a local transform for CPS. By and large, without some work ahead of time, it's hard not to do a global transform for CPS. ANF is local. It's still simpler than ordinary direct style in terms of machine structure, and it really captures the essence of runtime stack handling for us. So for anormal form, it looks pretty close to the CPS. I guess the difference is we've added I've changed the name call to body, and we've added two more constructs here. So now the body can be an expression. So because a body can be an expression can return, lambda terms can return an anormal form, just like we'd expect they normally do, which means that if we want to use something as an argument and it's not atomic, we have to let bind it first. So that's why we have this let construct in here. And here's a common way to handle this, a machine like this. This is a CESK-like machine. And the way this works to handle the stack and all this evaluation context you're going to build up is that it adds a continuation component to the state space. And what a continuation does is it tells you what to do once you finish what you're doing. So what this and the nice thing about anormal form is there's only one kind of continuation. So in more complicated languages, you have to have different kinds of continuations for every possible evaluation context, or use some sort of clever context mechanism, which we'll get to in a second. So what this continuation is telling you is, bind the return value, to this variable, continue on in execution, or continue executing in this body, bind that variable that we bound earlier in this environment, and whenever you've got a value for the body, pass it on to this continuation. There's a problem with this state space. So it's the same problem we fixed earlier. What's the problem with this concrete state space? Why won't it abstract well? Well, we only added one thing. We added this. Look at this definition. Does anything stand? It's recursive, exactly. So we could abstract it using another crude abstraction. Well, we're not going to get the precision we're looking for. We're certainly not going to get zero CFA or any of the KCFAs back. So we're going to have to do something different with it. So does anybody know what SML does with SMLNJ does with stack frames? How does it handle them? Anybody knows? It heap allocates them. We can use exactly the same trick to break the recursion out of this particular part of the state space. When you use that trick, this is the semantics you get, or this is the state space you get back. So now instead of a continuation, we have a continuation pointer. So these continuation pointers are just a subset of our regular address space, just some subset. And then, in addition to closures floating around in the store as values, we also have continuations floating around in the store as values. And instead of a continuation referring to another continuation, it just references the continuation beneath it with a pointer. So we've broken the recursion out of the state space again. Some people, when they do this, I think they'll actually add a separate continuation store, or sometimes they'll call it the stack store or something like that. You don't really need to do that. You can just mix them both together. There's nothing wrong with doing that, as I've done here. And this will abstract much more nicely once we get there. The downside to ANF, CPS had one rule. ANF has three different rules now for evaluation. So we'll go ahead and go through those three rules now. When you're evaluating a body, which turns out to be a call site, this actually looks identical to CPS. So all calls in anormal form look like tail calls unless they're let bound. So the let is where the frame allocation will actually happen. If we just covered this up and called body, or body prime and body call, then we'd have the rule we had for CPS. But I guess I can walk back through it again. So you look up the the closure you're invoking at this point. Then you look up all the arguments you're passing into that closure. You look at the lambda term, pull the body out. That's where you're headed next. You have to bump the timestamp, allocate the addresses you need to make the bindings to these variables. You make the binding to those variables, and then you add those bindings into the store. Now, the other thing you can do return. So if you're evaluating just a single expression, you actually run a return somewhere. So this looks different from CPS now. So if you're evaluating just a simple expression, then what you need to do is look up your current continuation. So you pull off whatever your current continuation pointer is, and you get the continuation back, because this tells you where you're going. This continuation has the variable we're supposed to bind or value to, the body we're going to be executing next, the environment to make the binding in, and the stack or the continuation pointer we're going to go to next once we're done. So we're going to bump time. We're going to allocate an address to bind the value we're about to look up to. We look up that value. So I started using D instead of clo. So D just means the notable value. I evidently planned at some point to have more than just closures floating around, but you think this reads as clo. So then you look up that expression. So this is the value we're returning. You pull the environment out of here. And by the way, this looks an awful lot like a closure, doesn't it? It's got a variable to bind, a body to continue on in, and it's also got an environment to bind in. It's very, very, very close to a closure. So you take that environment out and you make the binding with the address you allocated for the variable you're binding to, and then you have to add the value you got into the store. So that's how you execute return.
It's essentially the same as if you treated the continuation as a lambda of a
column. There's definitely similarities there. It's like we're really treating the continuation exactly as if it were a lambda, but it's phrased in different terms. And then for let binding, this is where we actually create frames. So let is what actually ends up creating frames or creating new continuations in this model. So we're evaluating a let term. What we're going to do next is evaluate the argument to this let term, whatever non-atomic expression we want evaluated, and it could be atomic too. And when that's done, we want to come back to this. We want to continue execution here and bind the result to this variable. So we have to make a continuation that instructs the machine to do that once it has a result for body zero. So this continuation says, whenever you're done, bind whatever ant you got back to V0, continue execution in this body, and extend this environment with the binding for V. And once you've got something, once you finish evaluating this body, pass that into this particular continuation, or whatever that continuation, or whatever this pointer points to, or whatever continuation that pointer points to. Tick allocates a new timestamp. We have a special allocator for continuations because we're not binding a variable now, so we have to make a different allocator unless we want to overload it. We look up. Wait a minute. What do we look? There's nothing to look up here. Okay, that doesn't belong there. Ignore that. And then we have to stick that continuation in the store. So we take the pointer we allocated and we put the continuation there. So those are the three rules. And this is the abstract state space we've got. It looks more or less the same as the concrete state space. So again, one of the big differences is we've got a power set here. So we have sets of values and closures floating around in the store. And addresses and times, once again, are finite. So we can keep the abstract states finite. And I'm not going to prove that this abstract state space is finite. I think you could probably do that by yourself at this point. You can rearrange it all and get the arrows pointing all downward. And these are the corresponding rules. They look mostly the same once again. So for a call site, we look up all the possible closures we could be invoking here. And again, there could be multiple closures because when you evaluate the function argument, you could get multiple closures back. So you have one subsequent state for every potential closure that you're invoking. You look up all the argument values you want to pass into the closure you've just looked up. And then to find the body you're supposed to go to, you actually look at the lambda term inside the closure. Then you're going to advance time, or whatever advancing time means in the abstract. You allocate the addresses you need to make those bindings. You'll make those bindings, and then you'll update the store again with the join. And the join means the same thing it meant last time. The store structure is the same. For return, it's also non-deterministic. So here, you're looking up all the continuations you could be returning to. So you have to, just like we previously looked up all the closures, now we have to look up all the continuations. You allocate some abstract time, create an address to attach the return value to, evaluate the expression that is the return value, bind it in the environment sitting inside the continuation, and merge whatever return value we got into the store. So for let, it's non-deterministic. There's no membership symbols in there. And the only thing that's really different now is that, again, this doesn't belong there. It's completely bogus. But I did remember to put the hats on it at least. We're joining with the store. So when we insert the continuation, it could merge with other continuations. And this is how, in this model, return points get merged. Because you can have more than one continuation living at the same abstract address. So if you invoke a continuation or a continuation address that has more than one continuation living there, you will fork. All right, so there's no way I'm going to finish this in the amount of time I have left. So I think at this point, I should probably cut it a little bit short and open it up for questions or clarifications. You all just understood it right away.
So there are lots of hacks you can do. If you actually want to implement it as a model where you're just exploring the state space, there are some hacks you can do there. Yeah, so the simplest thing you could do would be like keep a list. Obviously, you don't want to do that. What you'll find is that most of the state is not truly partially ordered. It's a flat order. So the call site, timestamps, and even actually the binding environment. Can all be totally ordered, and so you can actually hash on them. And so when I implement this sort of stuff, I usually have a hash table that maps from call sites combined with timestamps combined with binding environments and gives me back all the stores it's seen with that. You can simplify that a little bit and lose some precision by, instead of keeping a list of stores, you can merge all the stores that you've seen at a particular context like that, where I'm using context in a completely different sense now. Yeah, by context, when I just said context, I meant call site, timestamp, and an environment. Let's see other stuff you can do. So actually, there's a very weird representation based on something I pulled out of Gödel's incompleteness theorem. He uses an ordering on prime numbers, he uses a construction for representing strings and using the prime factorization, and it turns out you get. Yeah, we can take this offline, but you get big wins from reducing subset subsumption into stuff like modulo 0 or modulo some other number. So there are lots of hacks you can use to get really fast performance. In practice, though, of course, you don't actually explore the abstract state space. What we'll get to tomorrow is a monotonic function-based model where you actually go from one state to the next, and this one state represents all the states you've ever been to together, and this is actually how you end up getting to a cubic time zero CFA as well. Any other questions? All right, that's good enough for now.